Chapter 19. Stowaway. Earlier on Friday at Marble Island, north of Cobblestone Island. On an island in the Lake Passage due north of Cobblestone stood another aid to navigation. Marble Island Lighthouse was a conical brick tower with its keeper's quarters close by to the west. The marble light that shone at night could be clearly seen from Cobblestone's lantern room. However, Keeper Curtis and Iona Bates shared no similarity to the unfriendly pair of keepers stationed on tiny Marble Island. Fretting over having left Cobblestone Island in such a hurry, seaman Ross Clow shook his head as he paced the kitchen floor of the Marble Island Lighthouse. Iona Bates had given them decent meals at Cobblestone. Here, the only taste temptation to satisfy his hunger was a bowl of one kind of fruit. Bananas, spotted brown with age. Hardly an appealing morsel for a rugged sailor. Ross wanted a hearty meal. How he longed for Iona's bean and ham dish, or her thick-as-fog split-pea soup, with its man-sized chunks of ham. His mouth watered when he thought of the warm apple pie she had served with the ample cream. These enticing thoughts tortured him as his pacing picked up speed.
"Do you have to do that?"
Ross bellowed at Charlie Scruggs, who was drumming his fingers on the massive oak kitchen table.
"Wonder what's taking the captain so long?"
Captain Steele and the pair of young sailors remained on board the Wanderer docked on Marble Island. Thomas sat in the parlor, alone but composed.
"I'm not sure we should leave the young'un here,"
said Charlie.
"He seems mighty scared-like. I'd say we should sail him back home ourselves." "You heard the captain,"
fumed Ross quietly so Thomas would not hear.
"We're days late for Traverse City. You know we have to deliver those pictures. We probably missed our contact already. Conrad Warren said the man who plans to buy the paintings is a busy guy. He won't be sitting around waiting forever. It was difficult enough for Warren to get the decent price he did in New Orleans for those three pictures. And then he made the long trip north to get them this far. If we're to make any profit on them, we'd better get them to where they're supposed to be. We ain't got the kind of time to go back to Cobblestone and still make it to Traverse to sell those pictures. I don't know what's so famous about them scenes we gotta get to Traverse City."
This time it was Charlie's turn to shake his head in protest.
"Betcha that their contact man Warren would give a heap more money for them paintings of Barry's Island than them racehorses and ballerina dancers we got on board."
Charlie nodded his head in agreement with his own statement.
"That lady painter on Barry's Island paints more better pictures. And she ain't famous like Edgar D. Gass, neither,"
countered Ross, consciously imitating Charlie's wretched pronunciation just to rub it in, emphatically emphasizing the gas. On the morning before the women went to Barry's Island, Thomas had sneaked out of bed to return to the lake to do more late-night detective work. He had gone on board the Wanderer just before daybreak to look for the crate he was certain contained Edward de Bouteville's stolen internal combustion gas engine. Certain they had simply not taken enough time the night before to find the right crate in which it was packed. Thomas determined to complete the search himself. He was positive the engine was on board Sadie Thompson, or Wanderer. Thomas wanted to make the discovery in time to surprise the girls before they left for Barry's Island.
"Lillian would be so proud."
He longed to make Lillian proud of him. But Thomas did not know that Captain Steele had also planned to arise early that morning to sail away with his crew on the newly repaired ship. While Thomas was still rummaging below deck, he had heard the crew come on board. With no way to escape, Thomas did the only thing he could do, hide. He found refuge in an old fish barrel in the forecastle. But once they were launched and well on their way, the rocking of the boat through ragged waves, mixed with the stench inside the barrel, forced Thomas to come out sooner than he had planned. When Captain Steele discovered the stowaway, he fumed with rage, and rightly so.
"Throw him overboard,"
shouted Ross.
"Over my dead body,"
roared Charlie.
"Good, we'll throw you over too,"
suggested Ross. It was Captain Steele who finally settled his men down and decided to sail ahead and leave the boy behind. The captain had grown to like the smart little boy and meant him no harm. He was certain someone on Marble Island would sail the boy straight home. The 16-mile stretch would be an easy sail south, but Sam Steele hadn't counted on trying to deal with a pair of ornery lighthouse keepers who would refuse to cooperate with his plans. Chapter 20. A Plan. Saturday noon at Cobblestone Lighthouse.
"Says here the stolen engine was found,"
exclaimed Keeper Bates at the table while waiting for the others to assemble for lunch. Iona had given Curtis a recent edition of the Milwaukee Journal newspaper that Uncle Fred had brought over to keep his brother-in-law informed about the gasoline-powered engine.
"Says the caretaker of the museum took the engine away for safekeeping while he fixed the rickety legs on the display table. Didn't want the engine to fall over when people streamed by."
Curtis seemed amused.
"Thought it might break."
Lillian couldn't believe her ears.
"Thomas is gone, and Father is joking about an article in the newspaper? Mother and Father are too calm. Is it possible they don't miss Thomas because they have six other children? Or maybe they don't want to stir up unnecessary worry within the family. Yet I can't believe how they seem so easygoing about the whole thing."
Lillian tried hard to defend her parents.
"Our housekeeper is having trouble keeping calm about the matter, and Mother and Father do their best to pacify her nerves. Maybe holding steady themselves is their way of calming not only housekeeper Priscilla, but the rest of us as well. Oh, I don't know. Their attitude just doesn't seem right."
"Says the New Orleans Exhibition Center sends its apology for getting everyone worked up into a dither about the missing machine."
Lillian already knew the engine wasn't stolen.
"Will Father read about stolen Degas paintings next? How can Mother and Father be so controlled? Who cares about stolen items? My brother Thomas has been stolen. We have to find Thomas,"
Lillian finally exploded. Iona, who understood Lillian's anxiety, took her hand and stepped down into the summer kitchen for a private meeting.
"Lillian, I want you to read something,"
her mother said.
"I think it's important that you know about this."
She reached for a piece of paper off a shelf.
"Captain Steele left a note before he and his crew took off."
She read the note that thanked the Bates family for doctoring him toward good health, for feeding all of them like kings, for showing them more love than any crew of sailors deserved, and for helping repair their ship.
"Captain Steele was touched by our love and kindness,"
said her mother.
"Love again."
The other members of the household had gradually filed in to sit at the table in the main kitchen. Before Lillian and her mother joined them, Lillian felt the urge to share how she and some of the others knew all about the stolen engine and went searching for it at night on the ship. But she was too upset about Thomas being gone and decided now was not the time to make that confession. Instead, she followed her mother as they joined the others at the kitchen table.
"You have let your lights shine for our guests,"
Mrs. Bates announced to her family.
"I am proud of all of you for that."
She looked down at the note in her hand, then directly at Lillian.
"I don't believe they kidnapped your brother." "But how can you be sure, Mother?"
demanded Lillian, whose anxious thoughts fought with her mother's proclamation that they had acted as children of the light.
The boys found that Thomas had left his night clothes neatly laid out on his bed. You know he does that when he's up to one of his schemes.
Curtis added, to back up his wife's words.
Yes,
popped up Gabriel.
He does that, you know, when he goes off somewhere, so when he gets back and all tired out, everything's ready to go. It's not that he's organized, he's just lazy. Don't say that,
defended Lillian.
We thought he went with you girls,
added Luke.
We thought he was just leaving things in place for when he'd come back with you, like he's done before. But now, we figure he went to the ship to do some more exploring and was planning to get back to bed before any of us woke up,
added Garrett.
Except that the ship took off with Thomas on board, something like that. How do you know all this?
Asked Lillian.
We don't, dear,
answered her mother.
We are just supposing. We've talked the matter through plenty since we discovered he was missing. Considering the situation, I wanted you to be home. That is why I sent Luke out to find you. We're really concerned, Lily,
continued her father until Lillian broke in.
So what are you going to do? Just wait until he returns?
Lillian was incredulous at the apathy.
Thomas could be dead by now. Where is the search party? The Tonawanda came just before you returned from Cottage Perikaleo, Lily. It is going out soon. They're waiting at the dock. We've asked the captain to search for Thomas. Tonawanda Revenue Cutter came when you were gone, Lily,
Madeline piped in.
Revenue Cutter!
Exclaimed Lillian as she glanced towards Julia.
Mrs. DePier said she'd send one out looking for her sister's missing cobble shipment. Yes, while they look for Thomas, they plan to keep an eye out for the ship that was to deliver them,
explained Iona.
The Sadie Thompson,
added Deli.
You mean Wanderer,
corrected Paulina. Iona smiled because she knew the Sadie Thompson would never be found, which would be sad for Gwendolyn DePier, but a private victory for herself.
All of this happened while I was gone this morning?
Gasped Lillian, who was trying to understand the situation.
I'm afraid so, dear,
answered her mother.
We're all concerned for Thomas, but I really do think there is a logical explanation for everything. You know it doesn't pay to worry.
Their mother smiled, thinking about the part of the note she had chosen not to share with her family. Captain Steele had written how he had overheard her stern talk with the drunken Captain Joseph, whom she had accused as a disgrace to the United States Lighthouse Board, in writing. Steele complimented her on insisting that Jonathan Joseph himself build the fence on the cliff in front of the lighthouse, and how incredulous he was that she actually got him to do it. Mrs. Bates had reminded Captain Joseph that the U.S. government had ordered him to build it, and build the fence he would. She then had given him an ultimatum to have it finished in 24 hours by the time she returned from Barry's Island, or else. In the note, Captain Steele joked admiringly about her pluck, but secretly wondered what the "or else" would have been had Captain Joseph not completed Mrs. Bates's stern directive to build that fence. Steele wrote,
"I'm not sure who I would at all cost avoid tangling with, the rigid United States government or the formidable Mrs. Iona Bates, cobblestone lighthouse assistant keeper."
In the message, Steele also noted her kindness when she lovingly brewed Captain Joseph a stiff pot of coffee in the morning and fed him a hearty breakfast. What touched Mrs. Bates the most, however, was Captain Steele's acknowledgement of solid gratitude for her taking care of him at the point of death. This gruff, seafaring man was grateful to Iona Bates, who had cared enough to save the life of a total stranger to save him. Steele ended the note,
"You are a loving woman, Iona Bates. You forgive and forget."
And then in a P.S. he added,
"If you were a single woman and I was a marrying man..."
Then, over smudged print, where the continuation was clearly crossed out, Steele had scratched the following:
"Curtis B. is a lucky man."
Iona folded up the sentimental note and placed it in the pocket of her apron. She would keep that note, at least for a while. Lillian noticed her mother's smile. She also saw her fold and hide the note. She knew her mother had not read the entire missive to her. Someday she would ask her about it. Lillian was certain of one thing.
Under all circumstances, Mother absolutely refuses to worry.
Lillian, who wanted to be like her mother, simply could not shake off her personal woes. She forgot that her mother had at one time been 12 years old herself and had wrestled with similar misgivings. Lillian dashed from the table. She scurried down the 154 steps to the lake. There it was, the mighty Tonawanda, a United States revenue cutter about to take off on a search for a missing ship and a missing boy.
"If Thomas can stow away," she thought,
"so can I."
She raced down the long wooden pier and climbed aboard. Little did Lillian know that her little brother was close by on nearby Marble Island. The Marble Island keeper and his wife were the only residents on a desolate piece of land in Lake Michigan. This couple did not like entertaining visitors, and they certainly did not like trouble. Steele and his crew were clearly uninvited guests. They figured the curly, red-headed young boy with the upturned nose with them was nothing but trouble. The couple could not disguise their disdain over the predicament into which they seemed to have been forced. The keeper couple made excuses about their sailboat needing repair, which meant they had absolutely no way to get Thomas back to Cobblestone Island.
"I want to leave the boy here, ma'am. You'll think of a way when and how to get him home. It isn't all that far back to Cobblestone Island. You'll manage somehow,"
explained Captain Steele in the nicest tones his crew had ever heard coming from his undomesticated mouth.
"It's not my fault he was on board. I'm behind schedule, and while the wind is on my back to sail southeast, I have to push on."
Quite different from Captain Steele's tone and demeanor, the keeper's wife let everyone know how she felt.
"I refuse to be saddled with a boy who has no business interfering with my peaceful life on Marble Island,"
she proclaimed.
"He's a smart lad,"
encouraged Captain Steele.
"He's not my flesh and blood,"
objected the keeper's wife.
"And not my concern."
Charlie was glad that Thomas was out of earshot. He wouldn't like for him to hear the woman scorned. With no children in sight, Captain Steele wondered whether this lack in her life produced the bitterness she clearly portrayed. While her voice sounded harsh, she betrayed her true feelings through sad, longing eyes.
"You take him with you. He's not staying here,"
the woman stated with firm resolve, not wishing to continue the discussion or be the one to figure out how to get a displaced boy home. Captain Steele was in a dilemma. He looked at Ross Clow for encouragement, but Clow merely shrugged him off. Steele didn't even bother to seek help from his second mate. Surprisingly, however, Charlie Scruggs had already figured out a plan to get Thomas home. Chapter 21. The Search Begins. Saturday afternoon at Cobblestone Lighthouse on Cobblestone Island.
"I want to go along,"
pleaded Lillian on board Tonawanda.
"He's my brother. I have to find him. It's important to the family. It's important to me."
Lillian tried to make Tonawanda's captain believe she had her parents' permission to leave the island with them. In a short time, Lillian persuaded the captain to let her stay and was granted passage on board Tonawanda. Soon after she climbed on deck, the ship departed, leaving the towering limestone cliffs of Cobblestone Island a distant speck. On board, Lillian's heart felt like lead, not so much heavy with fear as loaded with love. She recognized the feeling as a pulling, longing to have Thomas back. As they steamed away from the island, Lillian watched Cobblestone Lighthouse grow smaller and smaller upon the rocky cliff. A melody popped into her head.
Hadn't I just recently sung the Martin Luther hymn in Bexley Bay at Grandpa Rady's church?
The words trailed along with the music as Lillian hummed the tune inside her head.
Shine in our hearts, O most precious light, that we, Jesus Christ, may know aright. Clinging to our Savior, whose blood hath bought us, who again to our homeland hath brought us. Lord, have mercy.
More than anything, Lillian begged for mercy, for love she knew she did not deserve. She understood that she had not caused Thomas's disappearance, but she felt responsible for having treated him so poorly. Her heart ached.
God is love, Miss Ruby had read. I must cling to God's love right now. If it is his will, he will bring Thomas home again.
Thou sacred love, grace on us bestow. Set our hearts with heavenly fire aglow, that with hearts united we love each other, of one mind in peace with every brother. Lord, have mercy.
Lillian's eyes felt moist as she pondered.
In peace with every brother. Sure, I still have Luke and Gabriel. But Thomas is also my brother. He's odd and strange and obnoxious and annoying. And oh, how I love him. Please, Lord, bestow your grace upon us. Keep Thomas safe. Bring him home.
As the ship plowed through deep water, Lillian subdued her thoughts with prayer.
Portage Island, leeward, sir,
shouted a sailor.
Shall we stop there to search for the young lad? Prepare for landing,
answered the captain.
Wait,
Lillian shouted.
What is that in the distance over there? I see something in the water dead ahead. A tiny boat with two people on board.
Chapter 22, Floating Away. Earlier that Saturday on Lake Michigan. Charlie Scruggs refused to leave Thomas alone in the hands of the Marble Islands lighthouse keeper. Charlie hoped to shield the boy from the vicious comments of the keeper's wife. He couldn't imagine what fate might befall Thomas if left in her care, or lack of it. Charlie had insisted that Captain Steele take off without him so he could return Thomas to Cobblestone Island. Charlie reasoned that Iona Bates would let him stay at the lighthouse for a short while until Steele picked up on his return trip from Traverse City. He also secretly hoped he could plan a trip back to Barry's Island to revisit Violet Rady. Without Scruggs, Captain Steele was not pleased to be left with only Clow and the two other crewmen to sail the schooner. But for the sake of Iona Bates, who surely missed her son, he decided to muddle through and try Charlie Scruggs' plan. He felt the skimpy crew could somehow manage to get themselves across the lake to Traverse City, Michigan. Once there, he'd pick up an experienced crewman for an easier sail back. Ross Clow, on the other hand, saw nothing good about the plan. All he could see ahead was more work for himself. Charlie wasn't much for smarts, but a stronger partner Ross could never find, and Charlie took directions. Not too confident the younger two sailors could or would obey his orders like Scruggs took his orders, he shook his head and walked toward the ship. A tough trip lay ahead. Soon enough, however, Captain Steele and his remaining three crewmen managed to steer Wanderer away from Marble Island. From shore, Charlie watched the ship depart, its mighty sails catching the wind in perfect order. Charlie noted the worry washing over Thomas, who seemed desperate about their own situation of perfect disorder.
"We've got to get off of this here premises, boy,"
Charlie whispered to Thomas as they watched the Wanderer sail away southeastward across Lake Michigan towards Traverse City.
"It ain't safe here. I'd rather be on them open waters than stay here and be lashed by the tongue of that fearful woman inside that there lighthouse. We should at least be able to make it to Portage Island, Charlie,"
Thomas calculated.
"Father says the keeper there is as nice a man you would want to know, unlike the people who won't even flash Father a signal as an alert that something is afoot. He could do that from their light tower, you know. On a clear night, Marble Island Light is easily visible from Cobblestone, but the keeper here refuses to create a signal. He keeps talking about Father and the two of us being after the gold. I heard the Mrs. Keeper talk about guarding the gold. Buried treasure, I think she means. She plans to find it in the waters around this here place. Doesn't she know we only want to get you home and don't care none about treasure hunting? No, Charlie. Greedy people don't understand worthy ways. Now, what is your plan for getting us out of here? Shall we try for Portage Island? I seen a boat landing on the eastern shore of this here island. There was some kind of rowing craft nearby, too. Let's find it. See how far we can go. Maybe to Portage. Maybe all the way to Cobblestone. But Charlie,"
Thomas shout back,
"Cobblestone is over 10 miles south of here. Can we make it in a rowboat?" "We can try, Sonny boy. We can try."
He scanned the lake and commented,
"The weather is set for a fair ride today. We can only try. If we aim for Portage Island first, maybe them lighthouse keepers there can sail us on to Cobblestone."
Charlie flashed his cavernous smile at Thomas, stared in fascination. Not a pretty picture, but Charlie's heart was a nut of pure gold. And this treasure was not buried either. Thomas had no need to seek the chest of lost coins, supposedly sunk near Marble Island during Civil War times. He had found more gold in Charlie, who planned to take him on a real adventure to get him back home. Crazy as it seems to row that far, Thomas completely trusted his buddy's inclinations and readied himself to act upon any plan the sailor had to offer. On the eastern shore of Marble Island, hidden among rocks, Charlie and Thomas found the boat landing and an old dinghy, paint peeling, a thin layer of wood at the top of one side missing. The boat lay upside down above the rocks beside a weathered, rickety pier. When Charlie kicked the boat, it stood solid, so he stepped aboard to test how it would float. He found it safe and motioned for Thomas to join him on board. The dilapidated paint made the craft look shoddy, but Charlie proclaimed it a safe enough craft for the jaunt between islands.
"Full sails ahead,"
he shouted, even though their trip across the waves would be man-powered rather than wind-pushed. Luck had it that sturdy oars in better shape than the boat lay tucked below the wooden seats. This dinghy would get them to where they needed to go. Charlie was sure of it. Portage Island lay miles ahead to the southeast. They would aim for Portage and see how they felt to either land there or continue on to Cobblestone. Charlie hoped for a kinder keeper, and as Thomas had suggested, one who might actually sail the two of them home. Although a fair journey stretched ahead, Charlie Scruggs would have no trouble manning the oars, and Thomas seemed able enough to row for a short time if he had to. With quick, easy strokes, Charlie launched the craft and plunged ahead, going south. Soon as they saw the white stone Marble Island lighthouse grow tinier and tinier behind them, as he rowed carefully and steadily, Charlie studied the quiet, intelligent Thomas, his strong, rhythmic rowing carrying them farther and farther on their jaunt ahead. With the weather seasonably fair, the air comfortably cool, and the lake thankfully calm, Charlie pulled onward for a long time with firm, regular strokes. Finally, his silent thoughts, too much of a burden weighing down his caring heart, moved him to utter,
"Them degas pictures ain't worth it to endanger the likes of a nice boy like you."
Thomas had been looking down at the water, staring at the waves lapping against the boat, making a game of it as he measured and compared their crests and troughs.
"Degas pictures?"
he inquired.
"What do you mean?" "Them three pictures Ross and Samuel are taking to Traverse City, the horses and the cotton seller people,"
he said, then added with a chuckle,
"and those ballerina ladies."
Thomas, who had not only been counting waves, but had also been thinking of DeBouteville's gasoline engine and wondering how he could have missed finding it, looked up with a start. His green eyes sparkled with insight. Watching Charlie row, barely a half dozen oar pulls later, he had pieced things together. A light flashed through his brain like lightning brightening a dark cliff. His eyes narrowed in thought, the slits of green glowing and piercing his ponderous thoughts.
"Pictures of horses, cotton seller people, and ballerinas. Degas pictures. Edgar Degas."
His mind raced to countless dinner conversations he had suffered through while listening to Aunt Julianne's stories of the cotton cellar and racehorse paintings she had seen with Aunt Violet in New Orleans.
"Where were the dancers?"
Thomas remembered Aunt Julianne saying.
"Where were all of Edgar Degas' famous ballerina paintings? I hadn't come this far to see horses."
He had heard her complain once too often. From his two creative aunts, Thomas Silas Charles Bates knew the artistic works of Edgar Degas. Thomas had heard more stories about ballet dancer paintings from these aunts than he ever cared to hear again in his life. But now he was glad he had listened with half an ear to their endless chatter. Now everything made sense.
"The crew of Sadie Thompson were pirates, but not of a stolen gasoline engine. They had stolen famous Edgar Degas paintings and were off to Traverse City to reap a good price."
Thomas beamed with understanding as he focused again on the graceful rhythm of Charlie's rowing.
"Charlie,"
he began slowly and deliberately,
"you didn't have an internal gasoline-powered engine hidden on board Sadie Thompson, did you?"
Charlie's open-mouth blank stare indicated to Thomas everything he needed as an answer in the negative. Chapter 23, Unwelcomed Visitors. Later that Saturday afternoon on Cobblestone Lighthouse. Sweaty and dizzy from physical activity they were not used to experience, Gwendolyn DePeer and her daughter Lucinda at last emerged from the long wooded path that led from Galena to Cobblestone Lighthouse.
"Well, I never had such a climb in my life. Imagine tramping that distance twice a day."
Lucinda's mother sounded incredulous as she wiped her damp forehead with a handkerchief.
Imagine those Jensen boys doing just that, to come to school at the lighthouse, and to think a real teacher, Miss Mason, had been right in town. However, Lucinda, if Mrs. Bates...
Oblivious to her mother's chatter, Lucinda looked down at her clothes, wanting to cry.
Mother,
she whined,
my mercantile pinafore is getting dirty. We'll order you a new one, dear,
soothed Mrs. DePere, who, for all the money she was worth, thought little of taking care of what she had in favor of replacing it with something new.
How we look, Mother. What will Mrs. Bates think? Hold your head high with dignity, Lucinda. You are the daughter of the richest man on the island. That will take care of any visible tarnish.
Lucinda's weak smile acknowledged her mother's advice. She soothed her pinafore, more grayish than white, and charged out of the clearing, head held high. Not Lucinda's choice to have made the mile-long trip. She had given in to her mother's wish to come along for an unannounced face-to-face meeting with Mrs. Curtis Bates. Midway through the teaching season, Miss Regina Mason, who had been the Galena schoolteacher 4 years, decided, at age 29, to dismiss her professional career for a domestic one. A longtime boarder at the DeBeer household, she had become interested in one of the workers who regularly showed up to discuss business with Mr. DePere. Regina delighted in long conversations with this ambitious man as he waited for an audience with the boss. They had married. Regina moved out of the DePere household, but continuing her job as schoolteacher. She announced her decision to retire from teaching altogether when, several months after their marriage, she was delighted to learn they were expecting a child. Mrs. DePere felt compelled to find a worthy replacement. Although Iona Bates wasn't a professional teacher like Miss Mason, she felt she might do for a while as short-term substitute. Mrs. Iona Bates, with a solid reputation for good discipline and high learning standards, stood at the top of Mrs. DePere's list of temporary replacement schoolteachers. But only if Mrs. Bates agreed to teach in Village Galena. Clearly as a bribe, Mrs. DePere had persuaded 9 families to contribute $50 each, with Mrs. DePere being the first to contribute to create a cash incentive for Mrs. Bates to switch her teaching location from the lighthouse basement to Galena's one-room schoolhouse. Mrs. DePere figured that bringing Lucinda along when she talked with Iona couldn't hurt her plan to persuade Mrs. Bates to relocate her teaching station. Therefore, Lucinda dressed up all prim and proper, ready to recite her multiplication tables and an English sonnet or two, in hopes of coaxing the able Mrs. Bates to be not just a part-time teacher at the lighthouse, but the prestigious school teacher for all the island children, for a short time anyway. Lucinda, who held no desire whatsoever to share a classroom with Lillian and Julia or any of the other Bates children, had only consented to the plan if Mrs. Bates indeed agreed to come to Galena. Lucinda clearly objected to subjecting herself to lessons learned in the dark, dusty basement of some old lighthouse. Secretly, she was afraid that Lillian and Julia were smarter than she was. In Galena, Lucinda was top of her class, well ahead of the children of those who worked for her father. She wanted to keep it that way. With her head held high, ready to meet eye to eye with a modest dwelling well beneath her own mighty status in life, all Lucinda could do was gasp when she emerged from the woods. She was greeted by a spacious lawn, an immaculately weeded garden, a grove of handsome apple trees flanked by blossoming lilac bushes, a sturdy barn, and a beautiful keeper's house with attached light tower. The house looked more like a dignified schoolhouse with a lighthouse tower propped upon the roof than a ramshackle keeper's cottage that she had expected. Lucinda could not contain her shock.
Mother, such an estate as this, such a house,
she gasped.
The Bates family could be richer than we are.
Mrs. DePere muttered that such an idea was impossible. All the same, she wondered how the Bates family could afford such luxury. Before them stood a lighthouse 2 stories high with a summer kitchen besides. What she failed to comprehend was that the United States had commissioned Captain and Mrs. Bates to live and work at the lighthouse. They were government employees. But Mrs. DePere never thought too deeply about matters that did not directly concern her own affairs. Up until now, Cobblestone Lighthouse held no interest to her whatsoever.
Iona, Iona dear,
Mrs. DePere called with false friendliness as she peeked inside the entrance to the supper kitchen. No reply.
Is there anyone home?
She called sweetly at the front entrance. Then, with a lowered voice, she shot a sly grin to her daughter and added,
"Let's look inside."
What she saw amazed her, because everything was modestly, although tastefully, decorated with absolutely nothing out of place, and certainly everything in shipshape order. With both the main floor and the upstairs checked and found empty of life, Gwendolyn DePere decided the Bates family must be below the cliff at the lake. She shushed her daughter, who moaned at the thought of more walking.
Come along, Lucinda. A few more steps won't hurt you. You're young and energetic. We have things to say. I didn't walk all this way for nothing. A few more steps? There must be 1,000.
Lucinda gasped as she placed her once polished white high-buttoned shoes on the first wooden step of the stairway going down to the lakefront. She looked down at what she perceived was a mile-long stretch of steps laying before her.
Imagine climbing this every day,
she muttered.
33, 34,
she counted, making her way to the lake.
My fancy shoes will be worn out by all this walking, Mother. Never mind about that. We'll get you new shoes as well. Come along. Don't dilly-dally. 117, 118.
The sun created prismatic sparkles on the glassy lake. A light breeze brought forth only the faintest of ripples. Would it have predicted something outside of weather and crops? The farmer's almanac could not have made a more dead-on prediction than Gwendolyn's guess where everyone would be gathered. Looking outward at an incoming vessel, the entire Bates household stood transfixed at the lakefront boat landing, side by side, their eyes intent upon the lake. Iona and Curtis Bates looked like museum statues. Luke crouched down between Garrett and Gabriel, who looked straight ahead. Julia, Paulina, Deli, and Madeline formed a hand-holding quartet, eyes fastened in the distance. Housemaid Priscilla created the only motion in the scene as she fidgeted nearby, wringing her hands inside her apron. 3 others stood at the top of the cliff, leaning upon the newly built fence in front of the lighthouse. With a dazzling glow, sunshine caught their faces and reflected brilliant shades of red from a garnet necklace, a ruby brooch, and a ruddy tourmaline ring. Chapter 24. A Horrible Sight. Saturday afternoon on Lake Michigan.
There's a boat coming, a ship,
announced Thomas, who had craned his neck to check out the noise. Charlie woke up from his cat nap and was stunned by what he saw dead ahead.
By Jiminy, if you ain't right about that. Looks like we're gonna get us some help out here. Give me the oars, boy.
The revenue cutter approached slowly but steadily. Trying to change rowers, Charlie and Thomas stood up in the boat, trying to switch positions. Thomas lost his footing, which put the boat into a precarious rocking motion. Trying to steady the craft, Charlie lunged forward, grabbing Thomas. Wrapping his huge arms around the young boy as protection from falling overboard, to outsiders, Charlie surely looked like a demon executing a death grip. On deck of Tonawanda, Lillian recognized her brother and perceived the scene ahead as an attack upon him.
Thomas!
She screamed. A sailor standing nearby, big and burly, jumped upon hearing the shout. Horrified at what he saw, Lillian continued her wild calls.
I'll save you, Thomas. I will. I will. I will. I can swim. I will save you.
With barely a thought, Lillian climbed up and over the railings of the cutter and plummeted into the water. Propelling her actions was the memory of 1 John 3, which she had read and memorized from Miss Ruby's book. We ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. She added thoughts of her own.
This is my brother in need, my brother whom I love.
The icy cold jolted Lillian's senses, but adrenaline pushed her forward. With quick, feverish strokes and with urgent energy, she swam toward the dilapidated rowboat still rocking in the waves.
Will I be too late?
She thought.
Will I be able to save him? Swim faster, faster, faster.
Lillian felt tears mix with chilly water. Watery eyes blurred her vision, and she told herself to close them and push ahead without thinking. Tonawanda's crew stood in horror. They had just watched a young girl hurl herself overboard. Lillian swam toward the dinghy. Her long skirt and high cloth boots slowed her down, but she had neither time nor strength to remove them. At the very least, they kept her warm in the icy waters of Lake Michigan.
Will I get there in time?
She thought.
Swim faster, faster!
Her conscience, however, tormented her. Accusations pounded her mind.
It's all your fault, Lillian. This horrible situation is because of you and your loveless attitude.
Her scream, thrown across the waves, released panic but could not quiet her nerves.
Hold on!
She shouted, although no one heard her, not even herself.
I'm coming! I'm coming!
Lillian glanced up, quickly brushing the water from her eyes so she could see clearly. In her frenzy, she perceived only a dangerous monster who had kidnapped her little brother, probably about to throw him to a watery grave.
One more stroke.
Lillian's thoughts raced faster than her arms could propel her forward.
Then one more, then another, and another. I'll get there, Thomas.
Her body felt heavy from the cold. But long, steady strokes pushed her ahead. Had she not felt as strongly about the rescue attempt, her body, too, would have sunk to the depths below. But love spurred her on. Love mixed with hate as she saw the rickety rowboat teetering. The monstrous figure lunged forward in a seeming attack on Thomas. Her fright in the frigid waters tried to hold her back, or worse, compel her to change direction. But she would not turn around. She gave no thought to her dangerous situation. Finding herself far from land in the middle of Lake Michigan, she felt destined to finish what she had begun.
I have to do this.
The vessel from which she had jumped lagged in the distance as she swam closer to the rowboat.
Go, go, go.
Her mind pounded. If her rescue failed, no one would save her. But she didn't care. She felt her mission, her body numb as she struggled to fight against the cold. Then, suddenly, her shivering limbs relaxed as she felt an instant thaw, the waters around her looking distinctly red. Lillian basked in the soothing comfort as she continued mightily forward, her strong final stroke sweeping her ahead. Although water splashed across her face, giving her a blurred vision, she at last reached her destination. Lifting herself from the mysterious surrounding warmth, the contrasting cool air blowing against her body, she shivered momentarily without losing a second of focus. Her knuckles clunked against the rowboat.
I made it,
she rejoiced. She threw one arm, then another, over the weathered sides of the battered and worn fisherman's dinghy. Her joy then turned to rage.
Leave him alone, you monster! Pick on someone your own size, you big brute!
Her words pelted the fiend next to Thomas, now hunched forward in the wooden seat. Lillian felt herself drawn upward by strong arms and then slammed onto the floor of the bobbing boat. Momentarily, she felt secure. Charlie lifted Lillian with the swiftness and grace of a seagull scooping up its noon meal. But devour her he would not. Instead, he held her in his warm arms for an instant before she began to thunder her fists on his chest. Her eyes widened in terror as she faced her brother's abductor.
Let my brother go! Let him go! You kidnapped my brother! Now let him go!
Then, from sheer exhaustion, frightened tears flowed in a flood.
Lily, stop! Charlie hasn't harmed me.
Thomas tried to pull his sister away without further rocking the boat.
He's my friend. He's taking me home.
Lillian shook off her emotional frenzy for an instant to turn around and realize her brother was in no danger. She was chilled, but a shock of warmth coursed through her as she studied the scene. Thomas Silas Charles sat calmly at the back of the boat with crossed legs and arms. Lillian looked back at Toothless Charlie, who suddenly clamped shut his mouth to spare her the sight of his disgusting, toothless, open-mouthed grin. As he smiled without parting his lips, Lillian relaxed.
You've not kidnapped Thomas? What are you doing out here, then?
She shivered from the biting cold. Careful not to rock the boat, Charlie took off his jacket and wrapped it around Lillian, who immediately enjoyed its soothing comfort. And forgetting himself, Charlie smiled, showing the cavernous horror of his mouth. But Lillian showed no alarm. Wondering if she would die from the intense cold, somehow she knew she was safe with Thomas and with Charlie. Chapter 25. Home at Last. Immediately following, on Saturday, at the Cobblestone Lighthouse Lakefront on Cobblestone Island. Iona Bates would never let her family know the panic that had pierced her heart, nor the terror that had torn her soul when she discovered Thomas was missing. She indeed trusted the Lord in every danger. She called upon his name in every need. But aside from that, she was also human. She knew that Thomas could be in a grave danger. As she stood at the Great Lake's edge, she tried to mask her feelings that mixed faith with fear, dark fear. Hours earlier, when she watched Tonawanda depart, she had seen Lillian on board and understood Lillian's need to be there. She had noted Lillian's look of longing, returning it with her own look of motherly hope that linked itself with human doubt only a mother could know when someone or something endangers her child. They both prayed.
Pray, Lillian. Pray for Thomas and pray for me. Pray, Mother, pray for Thomas, and pray for me.
Neither had any doubt that they would be seen through this crisis, no matter how it turned out. Yet their human fears lurked about, ready to pounce in a moment of weakness. Now, however, the dark mask of concern no longer hid this mother's genuine happiness. Within sight on deck of the incoming ship stood Charlie Scruggs with her two missing children, Lillian and Thomas. Hair wet, body shivering, Lillian stood wrapped in a blanket. Their mother breathed a sigh of relief and offered an even greater sigh of thanksgiving at the welcome sight. Gwendolyn DePere's gaze was not upon the incoming cutter, Tonawanda, the very boat she had ordered to search for the missing Sadie Thompson. She stood staring instead at a large mound of cobbles heaped upon the assorted jagged rocks lining Cobblestone Island's north shore.
Stones like these were to go to my sister in Milwaukee,
she announced, like a queen commanding her war fleet. She lifted her skirt to walk on the jagged boulders surrounding the piles of stones. Like a tag-along terrier, Lucinda Linda followed close at her heels. Mrs. DePere assessed the situation. Decorative, smooth cobbles piled together stood in a heap. The mountain of stone was surrounded by contrasting jagged pieces of limestone that lined the glistening shoreline.
This pile of rocks looks like the perfect adornment for a rose garden,
she declared with authority, totally absorbed in what she felt was attending to her duty in helping Kin. She neglected to see that Tonawanda had anchored and delivered even more precious cargo. With her back toward the Bates clan, she witnessed no joyful reunion. Lucinda, however, had seen the ship's approach and tried to get her mother's attention.
Mother,
she whimpered.
Mother, look. Not now, dear. I must figure out if this is really Aunt Miranda's order of stones,
she muttered.
She purchased enough cobbles to be placed around the roses throughout her courtyard, several tons. Let me see. Would this pile be enough? Yes, I think.
Strictly absorbed in her calculations, Mrs. DePere neither saw nor heard Lucinda walk away. Lucinda strolled toward the Tonawanda that had now landed. Curiosity compelled her to investigate the commotion, to find out why the Bates family had gathered together with such attention at the boat landing.
And without realizing that Charlie was trying to help Thomas, I jumped off the boat and into the water to save him, my lost little brother,
explained the animated Lillian to her family, although through chattering teeth. To Charlie, she admitted,
why, I thought you were strangling him. From on board, it looked like you were attacking him, about to throw him overboard. I was mighty thankful, Missy, when I seen that their cutter come along to pick us up. It saved me and Thomas a heap of rowing. Even I was getting tired out there on the great old lake.
At last, the children's mother turned around and made a fuss over the safety of both children. Then everyone began talking at once, offering appropriate congratulations to the rescued children and murmuring general condolences because of the anguish the situation had caused. Thomas and Charlie became the centers of attention as each unfolded his own interpretation of the story. Meanwhile, the enormous curiosity Lillian had noticed the presence of pompous Miss Lucinda. Shocked, however, to notice in Lucinda's demeanor a complete change of attitude, not one that dared to point, laugh, or tease, Lillian walked straight towards Lucinda while the others kept up their lively conversations. Lillian remained wrapped in a thick woolen blanket marked with an insignia from the cutter. Her hair was beginning to dry, her body slowly but surely losing its chill from the cold lake.
Lucinda,
Lillian began cautiously,
I'm surprised you're here. I'm surprised that you were so brave and jumped off a big revenue cutter,
Lucinda said with eyes opened in wonder and mouth agape.
Sometimes you have to do what you have to do.
Lillian tried to smile, attempting friendship. Lucinda seemed tolerable when she was not with her fashionable, fawning fan club. Lucinda warmed to the gesture and confessed with complete honesty.
I was in your house when Mother and I first came. We were looking for your mother, for anyone, but nobody was around. The door was open, and I went in. I went upstairs. You have closets in every room.
Lucinda's tone betrayed unmistakable awe. Closets were expensive. The government taxed closets like it taxed rooms, and few houses on the island had them, if they had any at all. Lucinda certainly had no closet in her bedroom in Galena. Of course, her parents did, but Lucinda accepted that as a privilege given only to adults. Lucinda felt too incredulous over Lillian's fortune to be envious.
Sure, we have closets in all the rooms. Lighthouses are government property, you know. We don't have to pay taxes on the extra space.
Lillian assumed everyone knew this common knowledge, but anticipated that Lucinda did not.
It's a lovely house, Lillian. I like it a lot.
Lucinda's less-than-complete humility warned her against admitting the Bates dwelling seemed grander than her own. Her father, Bertrand DePere, owned a lead mine in Galena, Illinois, and now headed the lead shot manufacturing operations in the village of Galena, Wisconsin. He knew this job well from his days working at the shot tower in Dubuque, Iowa. He was the richest man on Cobblestone Island. Even so, his house did not measure up to the standards of Cobblestone Lighthouse, or, at least at the moment, not to Lucinda. Lillian had closets, lots of them. She was impressed. Lucinda suddenly longed to befriend the girl she had for so long despised.
Oh, look, we have visitors,
proclaimed Lillian as she looked upward and saw the three standing high on the bluff in front of the lighthouse. Lucinda shielded her eyes against the sun's glare.
I don't see anyone. It's the Connor sisters, the ladies from the cottage on the South Hill. They hardly ever visit here, especially all three at once.
Lillian cautiously used the women's real names rather than the jeweled nickname titles she had bestowed upon them. She was excited to share her newfound knowledge of names with Lucinda. At the general store on Wednesday, Lillian had watched Miss Garnett endorse her charge of purchases with E.C., and Lillian had found the courage on the way home to ask Miss Garnett what the initials stood for.
Andira Connor,
Miss Garnett had divulged quite briefly.
And my sisters are Serena and Elvina Connor.
But that is all she said on the subject of names.
Connor sisters?
Lucinda was confused because she had never heard the name.
Yes, the three women who live at Cottage Pericaleo on the hill at the end of the lighthouse path, the nurses who helped me through my quarantine with scarlet fever.
Lucinda stepped back at the sound of the dreaded disease.
Connor sisters? Cottage, what did you call it?
Lucinda questioned.
I've never heard those names before. You must mean the Corwin sisters. Sarah, Elsie, and Amy Corwin, the triplet daughters of the former Cobblestone Lighthouse keeper, the ones who lost their mother in that horrible shipwreck in 1849 or whenever it was.
Lucinda always enjoyed a chance to show off what she knew. Now it was Lillian's turn to look confused. Lucinda persisted.
Are you talking about those three strange ladies who came to the island this spring? The ones who people say wear fancy red jewelry?
Lucinda held up her hand to shield her eyes as she squinted at the sunshine pouring down upon the cliff.
I don't see them. I don't see anyone. And, yes, I heard that you've been sick.
Luckily, Lillian had turned away. She would not have liked to hear her friends called strange, especially by Lucinda Linda DePere.
Hello!
Lillian shouted upward, and all three women waved in acknowledgement, their red jewels catching the sun and casting dancing ribbons of crimson up and down the cliff wall. Turning back to Lucinda, Lillian explained,
No, Serena and Dira and Elvina Connor from Canada. They were on their way to visit cousins in Illinois and ended up at the wrong Galena. Since they were here and are trained nurses, they decided to stay a while to take care of me at Cottage Pericaleo. They love it here on this island.
Miss Ruby had at last confirmed the three were indeed sisters.
Miss Garnett,
and Dira Connor, the oldest,
Miss Ruby,
Elvina Connor, the middle sister,
and Miss Termalina,
Serena Connor, the youngest.
Well, I see no one, and I do not know what you are talking about,
sputtered Lucinda as she swayed back and forth in the sun's glare in an attempt to catch a glimpse of the figures. She could not seem to combat that blinding sun.
All I know is that the Corwin triplets have come back to live on the island, somewhere beyond Village Galena, beyond the boat dock, and that they are very strange. Mother told me so. She said they have expensive jewels from the shipwreck of 1849 or whenever it was, and they have lots of money from their dead husbands who fought in the war against the South. And like you just said, that they are nurses or midwives or something, obviously since they took care of you.
Lillian crinkled her nose in a frown.
What fabrication has Mrs. DePere been telling her daughter?
She looked long and hard at Lucinda, who still gazed upward, trying to see the visitors.
And why is Lucinda paying attention to me today? She's so different. She usually ignores me, or taunts me. What is she up to? And why can't she see the three women on the bluff? I can see them plain as day. Why can't she? They are positively glowing up there. What do you mean that the Corwin triplets are back on Cobblestone Island?
Asked Lillian. She was eager to learn from Lucinda more of the stories people from Galena told about the three ladies who lived at Cottage Pericaleo.
Like I said, they're the triplet daughters of Felix Corwin, the previous keeper at your lighthouse. Surely you know all about them.
Lucinda seemed to be slightly perturbed at Lillian's scanty knowledge.
They took care of you, didn't they? Surely they told you what had happened to them 10 years ago. I've heard of the Corwins,
Lillian volunteered, sensing Lucinda's annoyance.
I know Mrs. Corwin died tragically, but that's about all I know. Yes, Deborah Corwin, the triplet's mother.
Lucinda proceeded in a sing-song voice as if bored from telling the story many times before.
Drowned in a terrible storm, trying to rescue some sailors from a shipwreck. Three of the sailors from the crash survived, lived at the lighthouse while they were recuperating, and ended up falling in love and marrying the Corwin daughters, Sarah, Elsie, and Amy, and...
Realizing the captive hold she held upon Lillian, Lucinda suddenly slowed her speech, deliberately pausing to make sure Lillian would comprehend what she would say next. Lucinda was surprised and pleased that someone actually had a sincere interest in what she had to say.
And there was treasure on board that shipwreck. Treasure the triplets and their sailor husbands kept as plunder. Red rubies and other gems like that.
In her mind, Lillian pictured the women from Cottage Pericaleo wearing their stunning jewels, a garnet necklace, a ruby brooch, and a ruddy tourmalina ring, all three shaped as hearts, all three red. She reflected upon an earlier day that seemed so long ago when she was first brought to them. Not remembering much else about that day, she remembered being enthralled with their jewelry. She smiled as she remembered giving them nicknames shortly thereafter, titles that befit the names of their stunning gems, names that they seemed to like, Miss Garnet, Miss Ruby, and Miss Tourmalina.
After he buried his wife, Felix Corwin gave up his position as lighthouse keeper.
Lucinda prattled on, not realizing Lillian was engrossed in her own thoughts.
He took his daughters and husbands to California to look for gold in 1850 or whenever it was, and they struck it rich, or at least we think so. We? What do you mean by we? It's what my mother says. and my mother's friends. Anyway, mother, figures the husbands fought in the Civil War and were killed, and the triplets decided to come back here with all their money. Mother isn't sure if they're rich from finding gold or from the treasure they found in the shipwreck. It's one or the other, though, or both. With all their money, they had that cottage built with a fancy southern porch on that hill behind the store outside of Galena. I've never seen it, but obviously you have.
Lucinda seemed her smug self again as she delighted in supplying Lillian with background information that she felt Lillian didn't know.
For some reason, they wanted to come back to Cobblestone Island.
Enjoying the attention from Lillian, she continued,
"They had a whole slew of workermen dismantle old Cobblestone Lighthouse and move it next to their cottage. I've never been able to see their cottage from the water coming over from Washburn Island. I suppose it's next to the old lighthouse up in the trees somewhere. Mother wouldn't let me go there with you being deathly sick and all."
Lillian's thoughts raced with questions.
So Lucinda's mother thinks the three ladies at Cottage Pericoleo are the Corwin triplets. Although I haven't known my three friends very long, I've visited them enough to pretty well know they aren't the daughters of the previous lighthouse keeper. If they are, they surely would have told me. They wouldn't keep that from me. They would know that I'd be interested in their lives as long ago children of the lighthouse keeper.
Lillian surprised herself when she thought of the women as children of the light.
Are they?
Lillian decided to ponder that question later.
It just doesn't make sense for them to be the Corwin triplets. Hadn't Mother mentioned that the Corwins still live in California? Miss Garnett told me she was Indira Connor. Connor might be her married name. And if they married brothers, they would all be Connors. But she didn't say Elsie, or what had Lucinda called the others? Amy and Sarah? No, she didn't use any of those names.
Suddenly, Lillian saw that Lucinda was staring closely at her glazed-over face. Breaking out of her daydream, Lillian stepped back and asked,
"Have you met them? Talked with them?" "Gracious, no,"
answered Lucinda.
"They aren't out and about very often. Mother has seen them at the general store, but not me. Besides, they are very strange. I wouldn't want to talk with them." "You're sure they are triplets, the Corwin triplets?" "Well, sure. Who else would they be?"
This Lillian could not answer, but she was quite sure her three friends at Cottage Pericoleo were not who Lucinda said they were.
"Miss Garnett told me their names, names that do not match up with what Lucinda called them."
As Lillian thought through the matter, she suddenly realized something was rather curious.
"Sarah, Elsie, and Amy Corwin have the same initials as Serena, Indira, and Alvina Connor."
Lillian had many things to ponder.
"I can't see anyone,"
Lucinda sighed once again, looking up toward the cliff in a desperate attempt to see the mysterious figures.
"They're gone,"
Lillian returned.
"Perhaps they decided to walk down to the lake."
By this time, a great commotion had begun. With Lucinda's mother, Mrs. DePere, in the thick of things, she talked incessantly while those around her could do little but listen. Iona had had enough and decided quickly that the only proper celebration for such a good ending that had ensured the safety of her children, not to mention a good excuse to escape the wagging tongue of Mrs. DePere, was to go back to the lighthouse and prepare a proper celebratory meal for everyone. Uncharacteristically, she employed the willing help of her husband. Arm in arm, the happy couple proceeded on up the long stairs to the lighthouse to prepare a feast.
"Has the ship Stella Townsend been here?"
Mrs. DePere continued, but mostly demanded, once again forgetting the ship's correct title.
Has it unloaded this pile of cobbles? I have reason to believe that this very stack of smooth, decorative cobblestones I found, obviously dumped over there, was to be shipped directly to Mrs. Miranda Adler of Milwaukee. Look at the lake,
broke in Thomas.
A new ship is coming in.
In the frenzy of Tonawanda's arrival, delivery, and departure, and the excitement brought about by it, together with Mrs. DePere's demands about rocks, no one had noticed the approach of a two-masted schooner. All eyes turned to the water. The entire crowd became mesmerized by the ship's unusual color. That contrasted sharply with the large black letters bearing its name. Considering its color, this craft could only be captained by a sailor, man enough to commandeer it. As Wanderer approached, Captain Samuel Steele, Ross Clow, and the two skinny shipmates waved from the deck and smiled at the crowd. None of the men seemingly ashamed to be surrounded by so much pink. Chapter 26. A Question of Piracy. Immediately following, on Saturday, at the Cobblestone Lighthouse Lakefront on Cobblestone Island.
Of all things,
gasped Iona as she heard the commotion at the lakefront. She turned around and looked out at the lake to watch Wanderer approach. Clinging to her husband's arm in determination to continue the upward climb to prepare a memorable meal, she mused,
Curtis, perhaps there is more of the story to unfold. We'll surely hear all about it over dinner.
Down at the water, Lucinda moved closer to her mother, occasionally glancing back and looking for the three figures that might be coming down from the cliff to join the crowd. Lillian found Julia, and together they approached the incoming schooner. With Thomas in the lead, Luke and Garrett followed. Gabriel stayed near Charlie. Paulina, Deli, and Madeline made their own trio, with Priscilla standing behind them. The colorful audience anticipated a glorious show.
Land ahoy!
Captain Steele shouted.
Come in ashore!
Ross and the captain and the two stick poles jumped off the ship to join the small congregation. Captain Steele looked unusually happy.
I came to pick up my able-bodied crewman, Charlie Scruggs, and head back south for Milwaukee. Milwaukee?
Blurted Mrs. DePere, delighted that she may have stumbled upon some good fortune to transport a special heap of rocks to where the collection belonged.
I thought you had to get yourselves to Traverse City to deliver them pictures,
broke in Charlie, who approached the safe company of his crew.
I had no need to get myself to Traverse City, Scruggs. Traverse City came to me,
the captain announced. Captain Steele enjoyed the attention of an admiring crowd.
I met Harry Hannibal of Traverse City on my way to Traverse City. Let me explain. We were sailing just beyond Marble Island when the captain of the propeller steamer City of Traverse hailed us over. He asked whether Clow over here or I had seen the Sadie Thompson.
Mrs. DePere perked up at the mention of Sadie Thompson.
When I asked what for, he told me that a Mr. Harry Hannibal was on board, looking for a ship that was selling some Edgar Degas paintings.
Unlikely, Charlie, Steele emphasized the D in his own unique mispronunciation of the famous painter's name. Mrs. DePere edged closer, her mind set on charming Wanderer's captain.
Well, I figured he was the very man I intended to meet, but I wanted to be sure. I fumbled through my pockets for a note where I had written down the name of the rich man from Traverse City, Michigan, who wanted those paintings. Think I could find that note?
He chuckled, knowing the outcome of his story would turn out in his favor.
Then I says to Captain Steele,
broke in Ross Clo, who wanted some recognition for his contribution.
I says to him, this here man's the name I remembered was written on that notepad he lost. I tells him straight out, this here's the guy. Yes, sirree, Harry Hannibal. He's the man we're looking for, the one we're supposed to meet in Traverse City.
Ross, obviously searching for praise.
How fortunate! Hannibal came looking for us. He saved us the trouble of sailing clear across Lake Michigan.
Julia nudged Lillian, and the two walked over to the boys.
Did you hear that?
Julia began.
Harry Hannibal? What's he talking about? Sounds like the name written on that notepaper Lillian found.
Garrett beamed in recognition.
Yes, but only sounds like. The paper actually says Perry Hanna, not Harry Hannibal.
Remembered Julia, who felt good about recalling such an important detail.
I wonder what's going on,
remarked Lillian, who turned back to the crowd to hear what else Captain Steele had to say.
And so I tells the captain of the City of Traverse that we had a connection with Sadie Thompson and that we just might be able to get this here Hannibal fella out with securing those degas pictures he was so eager to lay his hands on. Then the steamer captain and a man in fancy duds, which turned out to be Hannibal himself, came on board the Wanderer. And we showed them the pictures that had been transferred from Sadie to our Wanderer. Only when Hannibal took a look at the paintings, he said he only wanted two of the three. Of course, I was mighty disappointed he didn't take all of them. I was expecting $1,200 for all three because Captain Conrad Warren promised me that was the agreement.
Lillian's eyebrows arched at the mention of Conrad Warren.
Now this Hannibal fella wanted to pay $300 apiece for the cotton cellar painting and the ballerina sketch. Says he has no use for the racehorse picture,
interjected Ross Clo.
Let me tell it,
barked the captain, and motioned for Clo to step back.
I tells him $600 for the two pictures weren't enough for my trouble. Why, that was half what I expected for all three. I told him flat out, no deal. So he took another close look at all three pictures and said he'd give me $800 for just the two he wanted, and that was his final offer. He said I could keep that there third one or sell it or do whatever I wanted with it, that it didn't matter none to him what happened to it.
Captain Steele bit his lip and shrugged his shoulders. His wonder seemed sincere.
Can't understand why he didn't like that racehorse picture. To my mind, the horse picture was the only one worth anything in the first place. Nice country scene. Anyways, Warren and me are out $400, but all the same, we're $800 the richer than we were before meeting Hannibal.
He smiled broadly, his straight teeth gleaming white in contrast with the broken limestone on the shore. Lillian poked Luke with her elbow and urged him to say something.
Where'd you get the paintings, Captain Steele?
Luke asked, trying to sound only casually curious.
They're originally from an art dealer in New Orleans who sold them to a captain friend of mine. That there was Captain Warren of the Cotton Bell. Said he'd take the pictures as far as Washburn Island. Warren then offered the captain of Sadie Thompson a percentage of the profit if he'd sail them pictures the whole way to that there Hannibal fellow. The Sadie captain said the cut from the deal was worth it to him. Turns out, though, he had no time to make the full trip across the lake to Traverse City. Thought he could meet up with Wanderer, see, on the way over. He knew I'd be sailing in the region, which, of course, I was. We met out on the lake, and he gave me that there note I can't seem to find, with the names of the man in Traverse City I was to drop the pictures off with. Had the dimensions of all three works of art written on that note, too, so I was sure they were the right ones. I told him I'd sail the pictures right over if he could give me a decent cut myself.
Fascinated by the fabrication of this tale, Lillian's eyes were glued to Captain Steele, wondering what else he would make up to make the somewhat true story fit his needs.
The New Orleans art dealer said the pictures are famous, painted by a feller with the name Edgar Degas from France. Said they'd fetch $1,200 from Hannibal, the richest man in Traverse City, who wanted special artwork to decorate his new house.
Captain Steele made another attempt to look through his pockets.
I just wonder where in tarnation I put that piece of paper with the information about them pictures. Can't understand what happened to that note. I must have dropped it or lost it in a windstorm when I met up with the Sadie captain.
It don't matter none, Sam,
Charlie contributed.
You remembered his name and didn't have to go all the way to Traverse City. Hannibal came looking for you.
Unable to keep quiet, Lillian decided to join in.
So what will you do with the other picture, the leftover third painting?
Mrs. DePere could hold her tongue no longer and decided to answer Lillian's question for Captain Steele. She knew her offer would impress the captain and put him in the right frame of mind to do her a favor. Plus, this was an excellent chance to make a good deal, attaining a famous piece of artwork. It would impress the neighbors.
I'll take the racehorse picture, Mr. Captain. I'll take it sight unseen. Why, my husband is a member of the Washington Park Jockey Club of Chicago. It will remind him of the Washington Park racetrack he and General Philip Sheridan started last year. It is the Midwest's preeminent racetrack, you know.
Mrs. DePere relished the opportunity to brag about her husband's high-class out-of-state investments and also drop in a famous name and title.
Bertrand DePere will adore such a picture hanging in his den in Galena. He doesn't particularly enjoy my floral paintings in every room and every hallway, for that matter, and will welcome something more suited toward his masculine tastes.
Mrs. DePere continued her rapid chatter.
On second thought, I think I'll hang it in the parlor. It will be the talk of the town.
She proceeded to pronounce the freshman's name with great skill and care.
An original Edgar Degas. Oh, but first, do explain your connections with the ship, Susan Tompkins.
I believe the name is Sadie Thompson, ma'am.
Say, what business is that of yours?
Captain Steele flashed wondering eyes at the fast-talking woman.
Why, it is all my business, sir.
She continued with an air of annoyance.
I have sent the United States revenue cutter, Tonawanda, after her.
Captain Steele squinted his eyes. Ross and Charlie looked at each other in alarm.
I think that ship is gadding about trying to escape from something,
Gwendolyn DePere announced.
No wonder its captain tried to push off these paintings on you. Why, I have reason to believe that Sully Timkins is actually a pirate ship.
Thoroughly delighted in all the attention, Mrs. DePere reveled in the shocked look surrounding her.
I am determined to find that elusive ship if it's the last thing I do,
she continued,
and have it hauled in for pirating goods. How odd,
Lillian mused,
for Mrs. DePere to think of a Great Lakes schooner as a wandering pirate ship.
Then Lillian broke into a knowing smile.
Mrs. DePere can search all she wants, but Sadie Thompson, his one pirate ship, she will never find.
Chapter 27. Mysteries Unraveled. Immediately following on Saturday at Cobblestone Lighthouse Lakefront on Cobblestone Island.
The Sadly Thompsons was supposed to deliver limestone cobblestones for my sister's spacious rose garden. She needed a lot of stone to fill a courtyard designed especially for her imported French roses.
Mrs. DePere scanned the crowd to make sure she was making an impression.
I told her to buy our smoothest stones from up here in Lakeshore County and assured her that schooners are always making such deliveries. She is Mrs. Miranda Adler of Milwaukee.
Mrs. DePere rattled on, emphasizing her sister's name slowly and distinctly to make sure everyone was aware that this famous title was her kin. Lillian raised her eyebrows at the prideful prattle.
That boat never made the delivery,
the tall, lanky woman continued.
Why, I have information that Sadie Crompton loaded up in Morrison Harbor and then spirited herself away. Through the postal telegraph system, I have sent the armed steam vessel Tonawanda from the Federal Revenue Service looking for her.
Captain Steele felt an immediate dislike for the woman, especially since she had no intention of correctly naming his former ship.
And I believe the captain of the Sassy Thompson should be brought to terms when he is found. No less than a hearty fine for that scoundrel, with a jail sentence to go along with it. My sister may have to cancel her August garden party and the Milwaukee debut of her rose garden collection.
Captain Steele thought he'd have some fun.
Why, ma'am, in my course of travel, I met the Tonawanda. The captain asked about Sadie Thompson, too. I told him I believed she was headed for the Straits of Mackinac, where there's always a lot of boat traffic.
Well, I'm certainly glad you gave him that tip. Like I said, the captain of Sidney Tomplin will be sorry after he deals with me.
Now Captain Steele went in for the kill, deliberately pronouncing the former name of his ship loudly and carefully, because now he truly believed she was mispronouncing the name on purpose.
You think Sadie Thompson is a pirate ship, do you? Stealing rock cargo, eh?
He looked past Mrs. DePere's shoulders at the huge cobblestone pile in the distance.
There's enough rock right there behind you for your sister's rose garden. Why don't Clow and Scruggs and my two shipmates here load up this big pile of smooth cobblestones on a wanderer? We'll take them on to Milwaukee for you.
Oh,
the beam of Mrs. DePere's smile soared beyond delight. She felt she had truly charmed Captain Steele and directed him towards her wishes.
You would do that? I have reason to believe those cobbles are my sister's order, and that for some odd reason the schooner dumped them here.
She emphasized the ship's name with care.
You don't say.
Captain Steele made sure he looked properly shocked at the horror of such reckless abandon.
Well, actually,
blurted Charlie.
Actually, them rocks.
But Captain Steele clamped his large hand over Charlie's mouth and continued the thought for him.
Actually, my sailor man here, good old Charlie Scruggs, is trying to tell you that he and Ross Clow and the boys would love to help you out, ma'am, by shoveling those garden cobble decorations onto Wanderer and getting them delivered to your sister in Milwaukee as quick as we can. Isn't that what you meant to say, Charlie, old buddy? Wouldn't you like to do a favor for this charming woman?
Mrs. DePere blushed from ear to ear. Steele released his grip, stared Charlie closely in the face, and added,
"Wouldn't that just be something nice for us to do for that kind lady, eh?"
Taken completely by surprise, not comprehending a word his captain had said, Charlie simply stared back, and nodded in silent agreement. Lillian looked in bewilderment at Julia. Luke and Garrett glanced back at their sisters, equally as stunned.
Captain Steele seemed to have Mrs. Dipier completely fooled. Yet who is the biggest fool of all? Seems as if Harry Hannibal, whoever he is the real pirate. Won't Harry Hanna, who wants those three famous pieces of artwork, be surprised when those paintings never show up to decorate his Traverse City mansion?
Thought Lillian. Lillian curled her arm around Thomas, who surprisingly did not try to escape her loving grasp. He understood that something in his sister had changed, which made him pleased beyond words.
Thomas,
Lillian began cautiously.
I've been wondering about something I'm really curious about.
Thomas brightened. He liked curiosities.
How did you know we were looking for a gas engine on the ship that night? How did you know all the facts, all the dimensions of the box we were looking for? Actually,
Thomas began sheepishly,
I stole something myself, something of yours. I was feeling left out of your plans. I knew you four were up to something, so I decided to take Mother's suggestion to read that book she likes so much, the one she has read several times. The Susan Warner story?
Asked Lillian.
The Hills of the Shattamook? Yes, the one you were reading and left in Priscilla's room on her nightstand. I noticed Luke and Garrett weren't in bed, and I couldn't sleep anyway, so I snuck the book out with the intention of reading it straight through the night, but I stopped at page 20. Didn't you like the story? The story is fine, but Lillian, it wasn't too smart of you to leave Captain Steele's note as your bookmarker.
Lillian's face turned red with embarrassment. Ordinarily, she would have been upset over Thomas's brilliance and her inexcusable oversight.
Love feels no anger. So, I read the note,
Thomas explained,
memorized the details, and figured out exactly what you four were up to. Then, as you know, I met you that night down at the ship to help you search.
Lillian's newfound love for her smart sibling made her feel proud.
God made Thomas the way he is. Why should I be envious?
Meanwhile, Mrs. Dipier had a business deal on her mind. She glanced down at her purse, its drawstrings wound around her wrist. She bit her lip in apprehension as she approached Captain Steele, fumbling for a name to call him.
Why, Captain,
Mrs. Dipier searched for a name.
Steele, ma'am, Captain Samuel Steele. They know him as Roarin' Sam in Milwaukee,
Charlie spit out, but only the children heard. Mrs. Dipier was far too intent to make an offer than to listen to Charlie's chatter.
Captain Steele, about that third painting you have left over. We haven't discussed a price. You are so kind in offering to ship those cobblestones to my sister. Why don't I take that racehorse painting off your hands for, say, $500? Sold!
Roared Captain Steele as he slapped his knee, and with a wink he added,
and if I see that pirate ship, that silly pumpkins wandering around, I'll notify the authorities so that its devious captain get his due. You are a delightful man, Captain Steele. Unlike the disrespectful captain of the Sadie Thompson, not Silly Tompkins, good captain, you must get the name straight if you are to go looking for it. As I was saying, maybe that disreputable captain can learn a thing or two from you should you chance a meeting with him. Oh, I'll bet Captain Steele could learn him a thing or two,
Charlie blurted out with a ruckus yelp. But this time, it was Ross Clow's hand that clamped over Charlie's mouth. Mrs. Dipier left for home with the precious purchase under her arm, happy beyond words to show off how she could pay for a famous painting in cash on the spot. Never mind that the $500 dislodged from her purse was supposed to go for something else entirely. In her excitement at the moment, she had consciously and completely put the real reason she and Lucinda had come to the lighthouse out of her mind. She would take up that matter at a different time. Securing an original Degas was by far more important. Muttering wonderful things about racehorse pictures, Milwaukee rose gardens, and lake smooth rocks satisfied her thoughts completely. What's more, the haughty look on her face as she began her upward ascent to the lighthouse betrayed her worldly premise that everything works out for those who are clever, influential, and rich. She had to drag Lucinda up the long flight of steps as Lucinda dawdled, straining to gaze at the high cliff walls as if in search of something or someone. Back at the lakefront, Luke was also curious about something. He approached Ross Clow with a burning question.
"Mr. Clow,"
he began.
"Sir, I was wondering about something."
Luke hesitated.
"What is it, sonny? Spit it out."
"When Father was talking about DeBoutville's gas engine at the supper table a couple of nights ago, you threw Charlie a look that made Lillian and me think you were hiding what we thought was a stolen gas engine aboard your ship."
"Yes,"
interrupted Lillian as she recalled the incident.
"What was that about? We thought surely you were trying to keep Charlie quiet by the look you gave him."
"Ah, don't even bring up that topic, kiddies, or Charlie here will never give me any peace,"
began Ross.
"Gas engine?"
blurted Charlie.
"Here we go,"
exclaimed Ross.
"Charlie's all fixed on modernizing our ship here. He's been badgering Captain Steele for weeks to look into gas power."
"And you didn't want him to dominate the discussion that night?"
questioned Luke.
"Want you to know something about gas engines? I can learn you a thing or two about gas-powered rigs,"
Charlie encouraged.
"No!"
Both Captain Steele's and Ross Clow's hands slammed against Charlie's mouth to quiet him for the third time. And that ended all talk about gas engines, at least for the time being. Not to be shut down completely, Charlie broke away from his mates and walked over to where Gabriel and Madeline stood in complete fascination. Charlie reached into a pocket and pulled out something white. He smoothed out the wrinkles by pressing it against his chest. Dainty lace edges, tatted delicately, betrayed recent wear by the gray of its color.
"I believe this be yourn, little miss,"
Charlie smiled, pressing his lips tightly together to mask his black hole in his mouth. He did not want to frighten the beautiful little girl.
"My handkerchief from Mrs. Tivy,"
Madeline gasped.
"You found it."
And without so much as a second thought, she threw her arms around the big guy's neck and planted a thankful kiss upon his rough cheek.
"Mrs. Tivy from town gave this hanky to me for helping her son, Benny."
Charlie could have died happy that moment. He had known kindness from two lovely ladies in 1 week, a grown woman, artist Violet Rady of Barry's Island, and this beautiful little miss, had recognized the depth of his soul without casting judgment on his appearance. His heart having melted, he reached out and lifted lovely little Madeline into the air at arm's length and flashed his ghastly, toothless grin. To his utter and complete amazement, he found that Madeline had neither shuddered nor screamed. She simply flashed back a sincere smile in return. Chapter 28. Love Conquers. Saturday evening at Cobblestone Lighthouse.
"Carrie!"
shouted Lillian in total surprise as she met her best friend on the lighthouse trail. It was the evening of the fourth day since the shipwreck of Sadie Thompson. Four dry, hot, breezy days in a row.
What are you doing here? Miss Tormelina and I,
said Carrie, somewhat startled as she turned to her right.
What's wrong?
Lillian noted her confusion.
What's the matter? Why, I, Miss Tormelina and I, she, why, where did she go? Who, Carrie, what are you talking about? Miss Tormelina was here with me, but where did she go? She was here a minute ago. I saw all three not long ago on the cliff in front of the lighthouse. They were leaning on the new fence. I thought they would have come down to the lake, but they must have walked up here just to take in the beautiful view today. They never mingle much with crowds, you know,
replied Lillian.
They probably went home. Miss Tormelina was with me a moment ago,
said Carrie as she glanced over her shoulder in search of her missing companion.
She was? Yes. I have been so worried about your brother, Lillian. Father let me cross over from Washburn Island when I told him what you had told me about Thomas being missing. Father said I could stay the night. I've been dying to know if you found Thomas or not. When I was halfway through my climb to the lighthouse, I met the three on the trail. The other two kept walking, but Miss Tormelina asked if I'd deliver a poem she has written for you. A poem for me?
Still confused, Carrie turned around to search the forest pathway behind her.
Yes, from Miss Tormelina, who must have, as you say, caught up with the other two and gone back home. Carrie, you know Miss Tormelina never strays far from Pericaleo. That's why I was surprised to see her a while ago with the other two. But do tell me, she wrote a poem for me? For you, Lillian Bates. Come on, let's walk to the bluff cliff and watch the sunset. I can tell by how you're acting that Thomas is no longer in danger. I want you to tell me everything that has happened, and do not leave out any of the details.
Hand in hand, the girls walked to the spot where Lillian had seen her three friends on the bluff earlier that day. The setting sun threw soft strawberry pink apricot orange colored ribbons of light across the teal-tinted lake. The two leaned against the newly built fence. Lillian bubbled over with excitement, telling how Thomas had been found. Carrie's teary eyes reflected genuine happiness for her best friend's good fortune. She was not a bit envious that she had not been as fortunate with her own brother. Still, she felt emotional. Carrie listened with amazement as Lillian explained how Mrs. DePere and Lucinda had visited Cobblestone Lighthouse and had made friends with Roaring Sam, the supposed pirate captain of Sadie Thompson, or Wanderer. Lillian retold Carrie the whole story, this time in greater detail, the mix-up about the stolen gas engine, the Edgar Degas paintings, her plunge into Chilly Lake, Michigan, the missing Sadie Thompson, and the change in Lucinda DePere. Lillian explained to Carrie that neither she nor Juliet nor the boys were quite sure whether Roaring Sam had acquired those famous French originals legitimately to sell or if he had pirated them through a meeting of ships on the lake. The true facts were anyone's guess. Lillian and Carrie agreed that Harry Hannibal, posing as Perry Hanna of Traverse City, was the real thief who had pirated away at least two of the valuable paintings. The girls could only wonder what Mr. Hanna would do when he found out that his paintings had been sold to someone else, to Harry Hannibal, whoever he was. They decided that whatever happened, the week had provided them with enough excitement to satisfy their cravings for adventure, at least for a while.
Carrie,
Lillian felt close to her understanding friend.
I almost told my mother how we went snooping in Captain Steele's schooner that night to find the gas engine, but only found the box of paintings. But I couldn't. All I could think about was how Thomas was gone. Sure. And well,
Lillian smiled.
I should tell Mother and Father the whole story, I suppose. But all I can think about now is how happy I am that Thomas is back again. Right now, going aboard the ship that night doesn't seem to matter. Maybe someday you'll know when to tell them. Yes, I suppose so.
Lillian smiled because Carrie really did understand. Lillian and Carrie sniffled and giggled in celebration of their close friendship. As the evening darkened, they saw that Lillian's father had lit the lighthouse lamp. The light's beam shot across the waves, and the two enjoyed a moment of silence. Finally, Carrie unfolded the piece of paper she had tucked away in one hand, the poem that Miss Tormelina had written for Lillian. Feeling this moment as the perfect time to share, she led Lillian to sit on the nearby stone bench. The evening continued to darken, and the fixed light from above illuminated the handwriting on Miss Tormelina's note. As Carrie handed Lillian the poem, Lillian's voice softened to a whisper as she read the words out loud.
To Lillian. When days are filled with wants and needs, when pleasing self instructs our deeds, we look inside to satisfy. We fill our hearts with what we eye. How lonely such a life we lead. How self-absorbed our wants we feed. We grapple, struggle, kick each day. We never cease to want our way. So thoughtless is this daily creed. So vile to plant such worthless seed. We seek a straighter way to go. We strive a richer boat to row. In 1 John 4, the words we read in simple style, our souls are freed. We love another more than we. We know that Jesus is the key.
Lillian slowed in her reading of the final stanza. Her voice was barely audible.
Now, love your brother, this he pleads. Now, pull out deep and thoughtless weeds. We cannot on our own this do. We leave the work to him, not you.
Understanding the pointed personal intent, Lillian repeated the last two words.
Not you.
Carrie rested her head on her best friend's shoulder, reading at an angle, wondering why Miss Tormelina had chosen such words. What seemed like the passing of minutes was actually a mere moment. Neither spoke. Lillian closed her eyes and pondered the words, not you. She understood. Her thoughts filled with the wonder of grace known and grace shared. She glanced at the poem again, this time reading between the lines.
Not me. I have felt great longing, longing to satisfy myself. I have been self-absorbed and lonely. I have kicked my poor Thomas. I have planted vile seeds. I have steered my life's boat in a dangerous direction. Then love found me. Love set me free. Thomas is my brother, and I love him. I never realized it until now. Without Jesus, no one is my brother. I cannot love on my own. Carrie?
Carrie raised her head.
Carrie, when I jumped off Captain Driver's fishing yawl, yes, I had a real longing to swim. I couldn't resist the urge. I know. And when I did swim, I loved it. I know. The longing is still there. Okay. But something has changed. You see, I never felt quite right about why I wanted to swim at first. But now I feel different. I feel it's all right now.
Carrie studied Lillian, intently serious, entirely sincere.
And I think Miss Garnett has been trying to help me understand the importance of knowing the difference. The difference? The difference between why I wanted to swim a week ago, which wasn't a good reason at all, and Miss Garnett somehow knew it wasn't a good reason, and realizing that if I thought about it deeply enough, I might discover a better reason to swim, which I have, and am I making any sense, Carrie?
As Lillian searched for words, she saw Carrie's face bathed in the dusky light of evening, and was thankful for the uniqueness of their friendship. With her thoughts tumbling through her mind, she was unable to speak.
Carrie, how can I explain to you that I wanted to be like the children of Galena? Will you understand how I felt? The children of Galena have things I don't have. They do things I don't do. A week ago, all of that mattered to me. A week ago, my desire to swim was a desire to be like them. But now that I've tried it, my wanting to swim has nothing to do with an evil intention to imitate them. I am special, a child of the light, Carrie, and you are too. Now I want to swim simply to swim. It was a longing I've had for a long time. The reason behind the longing is different now. This change is a wonderful gift. I feel free.
Lillian struggled for words because trying to explain herself was not coming easily.
Carrie, at first, I wanted to swim but now I realize my reason is different because...
Lillian's intensity, her sincerity, her searching for words astonished Carrie. Lillian seemed to have so much to say, but seemed to have so little power to express her thoughts, even to her best friend Carrie. Lillian took a deep breath.
Oh, dare I say this to her? You see,
she continued,
almost losing Thomas. Oh, will Carrie understand if I tell her this? Made me understand. Yes?
Carrie understood. Lillian's intense thoughts continued.
You loved Soren and then lost him. I hated Thomas, but did not lose him. Oh, Carrie, it doesn't seem fair at all for you. I don't want this to be painful for you. We can't judge the fairness of God. This thing with almost losing Thomas made me understand. Oh, Carrie,
Lillian thought,
I hope you know that you've always understood what is important, and that is why losing Soren is so hard. But you also understand God's will, and I didn't until now. Carrie, what I mean is almost losing Thomas made me understand what's important, and that has changed my reason for wanting to swim. Miss Garnett told me that understanding why we do things is important. Now I know why I want to swim, why I really want to swim, why I'm not afraid to, because I had thought it might be wrong. Knowing sets me free.
Carrie said nothing. She noticed a slight smile edge onto Lillian's face and wondered what she was thinking. She remained silent, offering Lillian time to collect her thoughts. She knew Lillian would share when she was ready to.
Carrie,
Lillian began,
I still can't believe that my mother let our family swim at Galena's beach this week, alone. I've been bothering her about swimming a lot lately, and mother has been quite firm about not letting me go. She seemed more cautious than ever, especially since Soren's accident. Oh, why did I just say that? Carrie, I'm sorry. This is the second time I've brought up what happened to your brother at the lake. Oh, Carrie, I'm... That's okay.
Carrie lowered her head. She thought about the attention Lillian had offered when her brother Soren had died. Lillian's heartfelt sorrow then, when Carrie needed someone to grieve with her, comfort her a lot. And Carrie actually liked people bringing up Soren's name. But most wouldn't, or couldn't. Bringing up Soren's name meant that he had not been forgotten.
Mother isn't a worrier,
Lillian continued, proceeding with caution.
But
She hasn't been too excited about my wanting to swim. I can just sense that she doesn't want me or any of us to be in danger. I told her I feel strange that our family doesn't swim. I mean, everybody in Galena does, Carrie. We're not that busy that we can't swim once in a while. I think I hurt Mother's feelings when I said that to her.
Lillian looked at Carrie to determine whether speaking openly had now hurt her feelings. She only saw in Carrie's face a look of true concern, so she persisted.
Ever since what happened to your brother, Mother has been more protective than ever. Then when she actually told us to swim, she seemed suddenly okay with the whole idea. It's odd, Carrie. It's like she personally asked for guardian angels to come to the beach with us or something.
She sighed at the incredible idea.
Maybe she did, Lily. Maybe she did pray for angels to watch over you.
Lillian's sigh faded into seriousness.
Yes, well, I just know I feel right about swimming now, and that for whatever reason, it's okay with Mother now, too.
Lillian turned to look at her friend directly. She continued with great passion.
Carrie, I feel I can really love swimming now.
Carrie said nothing.
And love other things, too. Things? Well, people. Oh?
Lillian let go of Carrie's hands. She smiled with the satisfaction of understanding her own heart. Lillian chose not to explain her newfound feelings for Thomas.
I think Carrie knows how I feel about Thomas now,
she decided. But Carrie could never know that a new thought suddenly swept through Lillian's mind, an idea even Lillian couldn't fully comprehend. In a burst of passion, characteristic of a spontaneous personality that so easily acts on impulse, Lillian made up her mind. She would do something unbelievable. Get to know storekeeper Mr. Scarsley. Soon. Maybe tomorrow, or whenever the chance would come up, to understand him like she learned to understand Thomas. As the sun sunk below the horizon, Lillian looked through the dusk at the distant water, quiet and peaceful. She thought of Captain Steele.
Why does he treat his crew with such anger?
Her thoughts drifted toward Lucinda DePere in her perfect store-bought clothes, but less than perfect attitude toward those outside her tight circle of friends.
Why does she scorn everyone not like her?
Lillian considered the recent events of her adventure with the wandering pirate ship, the ship that pirated both a load of cobblestones meant for Milwaukee, then three paintings meant for Travis City. A light of empathy toward Lucinda and the captain filled her heart. She smiled, thinking of her snug bed in the lighthouse.
I will pray tonight that the light of love fill Lucinda's, the captain's, and Mr. Scarsley's hearts as it has filled mine.
Lillian sighed as she harbored these thoughts with childlike faith. She had begun to understand love, to cherish it in her heart, and to learn how to give it away. She also felt a sudden urge to share these thoughts with her sister.
Let's look for Julia,
Lillian suggested.
I think she's read your mind,
countered Carrie.
Look, here she comes.
Lillian turned around to see Julia bounding toward them.
Mother was wondering where you two were,
Julia called out.
It's late. You should come in. I think you're the one who wonders where we have been, Julia.
Lillian smiled. Without wishing to keep anything from her sister, Lillian grabbed Carrie's hand and pulled her off the bench to meet approaching Julia. Together, the three girls climbed the outside steps leading into the side door to the lighthouse dwelling.
It will be the three of us in our cozy bed tonight. Carrie can stay over,
Lillian explained.
And boy, do we have things to talk about.
She held up Miss Tormelina's letter.
We have a poem to share with you, Julia.
The last one to step into the lighthouse, Carrie walked straight toward a flower vase that Iona Bates had moved from the kitchen table into the front entrance foyer. The vase sat atop the lighthouse tender's newly delivered library box of books. Transfixed, Carrie stared at the familiar but fresh blooms.
"Those aren't the flowers we picked in our meadow, are they?"
she asked. Sure enough, the week-old wildflowers stood as straight and fresh as the day the girls had picked them.
"I don't know. I guess they are."
Lillian sounded casual.
"Come on, upstairs. We have so much to talk about tonight. Things even more important than wildflowers we picked for Mother last Sunday."
Carrie's brows arched as high as the clouds, her eyes still staring incredulously at the flowers. On her way toward the climb upstairs, Julia also paused to study the contents of the vase. Lillian had lost no time clambering upwards, her heart brimming full of expectations.
"Come on,"
she called down to the two lagging behind as they pondered the lifespans of Lobelia and Asphodel.
"Let's go. We need to talk."
Carrie turned around to glance at Julia, whose eyes were fastened on the vase. They looked at each other, at the flowers, and then back at each other, instantly recognizing their simultaneous exchange of insight.
"Yes, Lily, I think we have an awful lot to talk about tonight."
Julia smiled as she grabbed Carrie's hand and pulled her up the stairs. As the girls tumbled into bed, they bubbled with excitement, their eager chatter centered on the events of the week. Mesmerized by the contents of Miss Tormelina's poem, Julia led Carrie into a discussion about the entrancing wildflowers, that somehow their mysterious ability to stay fresh had something to do with their visits to Cottage Pericaleo. As Julia and Carrie hammered out various theories and ideas about the flowers, Lillian's thoughts drifted off in a different direction. Less concerned with the transformation of flowers, Lillian concentrated on the transformation within herself. Her heart harbored more love than she ever dreamed possible, and she knew Miss Garnet, Miss Ruby, and Miss Tormelita had much to do with this important new feeling. Soon, Carrie and Julia's chatter died down. Resting comfortably on her pillow, Lillian pulled the covers up to her chin. She closed her eyes.
"This quilt still smells like Captain Steele,"
she smiled.
"What a week this has been. I'm so thankful for Thomas."
Lillian drifted off to sleep with thoughts of a happy future. A future she felt certain would turn out well as long as her heart was enlightened with love. To God be the glory.
Holy Ghost, with light divine, shine upon this heart of mine. Chase the shades of night away. Turn the darkness into day.
Epilogue. 2 weeks later, Sunday evening, June 29, at Cobblestone Lighthouse on Lake Michigan, Lakeshore County, Wisconsin, 1884. In her nightgown, Lillian stood in the hallway just outside the kitchen, eavesdropping on her parents' conversation. From Luke and Garrett, the couple had indeed heard all the details about Captain Steele, Harry Hannibal, and Mrs. DePere's big artistic purchase. They chose to say nothing, yet frequently glanced at each other, offering a knowing wink or producing a wry smile, suggesting they would not tell all they knew, especially to Gwendolyn DePere. It hadn't seemed to matter. Holding the latest edition of the Lakeshore Advocate, Curtis Bates read to his wife, out loud, a brief, obscure article that had caught his eye.
"Lawsuit filed. Well-known Perry Hanna of Traverse City, Michigan, has filed a lawsuit against art expert Harry Hannibal of Elk Rapids. There appears to be unclarity concerning the value of three artworks by Edgar Degas, two of which have turned up at the East Side Picture Show Art Gallery of Traverse City. The whereabouts of the missing third work, heretofore recognized as an original, unverified, is unknown.
Perry Hanna, Lillian couldn't believe what she had just heard.
Perry Hanna found out about Harry Hannibal. I had been wondering all along, Curtis,
Iona commented,
why that Hannibal fellow had only taken two of the paintings. Being an art expert, he must have known the third one was likely a fake. I imagine he did recognize the two originals,
her husband said.
Bought them cheap from Captain Steele, then sold them for a profit to the East Side Picture Show. But who do you suppose this Perry Hanna fellow is? Should I tell them the whole story?
Lillian wondered, still listening from the hallway.
I don't know, dear,
answered Iona.
But I'm guessing he is the man who is actually supposed to receive the paintings for a more reasonable price than that Michigan Art Gallery charges. How does Mother know these things?
Lillian was incredulous.
In any case, I don't want to be around Gwendolyn DePere if she reads this item and suspects she may be swindled into having bought fraudulent artwork,
continued Iona.
Her lawsuit would not be hidden on an inside page. She would make her lawsuit front page headlines. Ha! Mrs. DePere paid all that money for a possible fake.
Lillian smiled with satisfaction. Then, because she was a child of the light, she was moved to hope that Mrs. DePere would somehow never see or hear this piece of news.
I do love my brother Thomas,
Lillian admitted to herself.
Now, I've actually learned how to love Mrs. DePere, which is nothing short of a miracle.
At Cottage Pericaleo, three women, one studying at a writing desk, one baking in the kitchen, and one creating poetry in a loft, paused from their task to simultaneously ponder what they had recently tried to teach Lillian. First, throughout her weeks of recovery, and then throughout her weeks of freedom that followed. Red reflections created streaks of light that danced across the walls and ceilings as one woman fingered her ruby brooch, one touched her garnet necklace, and one flashed her tourmaline ring. The room transformed into a ruddy glow. From the hallway, Lillian watched her mother flip through the family Bible that lay open on the kitchen table. Iona sat alone because her husband had gone upstairs to the lantern room.
Now, where is that psalm?
Lillian heard her mother ask herself.
Is it 32 or 33? Ah, here it is. Psalm 34, verse 7. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them.
As Iona Bates closed the book with a thankful smile, Lillian also smiled as she tiptoed away from the kitchen to climb upstairs. Soon Lillian lay nestled next to Julia in their cozy bed. Had her sister not been enjoying a deep slumber, Lillian would have awakened her to point out the beautiful flashes of light that darted about the room.
These are crazy reflections, no doubt from the lighthouse, although I've never seen these colors before, and they kind of look like hearts, and they're red. But Cobblestone Lighthouse throws out a fixed white light.
She let out a slow yawn.
Remnants of the sunset, I guess.
A second yawn.
I am very happy,
Lillian concluded as she watched the lights, the brilliant rhythms hypnotizing her. She felt at peace with the world.
Thank you, God,
she began her nighttime prayers.
For brothers and sisters, for my parents, and for Carrie.
The softening lights began to lull her to sleep.
Thank you for my three special friends at Cottage Pericaleo who have helped me.
She paused as her mouth opened into a third yawn.
Who have helped me?
She continued out loud, although halted by yet another yawn.
Who have helped me?
Lillian's voice trailed into nothingness as the unusual hovering russet glows found a resting spot over her pillow. The light slid upon Lillian and enveloped her much like the sudden mysterious warmth in the cold waters of Lake Michigan had strengthened her body and spirit when she had struggled to save Thomas in the rickety dinghy. Lillian's lips parted slowly as they formed a compassionate smile. She continued her broken prayers, this time out loud.
Thank you for my three special friends who have helped me gain a new understanding of...
Lillian had fallen asleep, bathed in happiness, knowing she was a child of the light, who, without outwardly admitting, had finally come to a closer understanding of love.
Historic note from the author. Did pirates exist on the Great Lakes? Roaring Dan Seavey did. Although at times a courteous gentleman, Captain Seavey's fame came from his image as a rough and tough pirate. And he was arrested as one. A Milwaukee Journal article, date unknown, entitled Two-Fisted Pirate is Lakeport Legend, states that on June 11th, 1908, Seavey was actually taken to court and tried for pirating the lumber schooner, Nellie Johnson. Seavey and two crewmen had taken the sailing vessel out of a Michigan port and set themselves on a course bound for Chicago. The United States revenue cutter Tuscarora went after them and eventually captured the thieves. Seavey had made it to Chicago, but not according to his plan. Tried there as a pirate, the court eventually acquitted him, giving him the title ever after as the Old Pirate. Two sisters, Jerry Lynn Betts and Lori Betts Lorenz, heard from relatives that their great-grandmother, Emily Roan Betts, had housed and fed a Great Lakes pirate. Emily did this on small Rock Island in Door County, Wisconsin, where she raised nine children and assisted her husband as a lighthouse keeper. Could Emily's pirate guest have been Roaring Dan? Does the newspaper clipping about Dan found in a Betts family scrapbook provide the proof? History proves a Great Lakes pirate did exist. Although fiction, the Wandering Pirate Ship builds on this historical fact. Pottawatomie Lighthouse on Rock Island, where William C. Betts kept the light for over 16 years, provides authentic background. His original lighthouse log from 1872 to 1886, newspaper articles about his island adventures, personal excerpts from the Betts family scrapbook, and Roan family letters add historical authenticity to these Children of the Light stories. May the adventures continue.
This book was created for use of blind and visually impaired people under the provisions of the Chaffee Amendment 17 to the United States Code 121, which grants the right to produce accessible formats of literary and musical works for the blind or print-disabled persons. Sharing this audiobook with others is considered a copyright infringement. When you have finished this book, please return this audiobook in the provided mailer to the Mission for the Visually Impaired.